The next case on our calendar is State of Ohio, Ex Rel American Legion Post 25 versus the Ohio Civil Rights Commission. And for the appellant, Mr. William Marshall. Mr. Marshall.
Good morning. May it please the court, Bill Marshall for the Civil Rights Commission. I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent's position that it is a right to force the commission to issue a subpoena on its behalf during the investigatory stage of a commission proceeding is erroneous and, if adopted, would undermine the very ability of the Ohio Civil Rights Commission to combat discrimination throughout the state of Ohio. This is so for 3 reasons. First, the statutory language that subpoenas may be issued, quote, to the same extent and subject to the same limitations, end quote, as the commission does not refer to when or to the stage of a proceeding. It only means that when subpoenas are available to the respondents, they are available on the same bases, forms, mechanics, availability of sanctions, et cetera, as they are to the commission. Second, respondents' so-called equal footing claim does not apply to agency investigations, which are necessarily not bilateral. Respondents are entitled to equal footing during the bilateral adversary stage of a commission action, and that is exactly what the statute allows. Third, the commission investigates 5,000 charges per year, and allowing full-scale adversarial discovery during the investigatory stage would open the process to abuse and prevent the commission from doing its job. Let's start with the statutory language.
Counsel, before you get there, I have a question. Procedurally, how would it have been envisioned if there was a forced subpoena and the commission was to bring in this parole officer or probation officer, I can't remember which, who would theoretically be asking the questions at that stage of this individual under a subpoena for the Legion?
If it was a subpoena for the Legion, as would occur during the adversarial stage when we contend the subpoenas are available, it would be the Legion that would be able to conduct the discovery.
But we weren't at the adversarial stage. It was the investigative stage, and the commission was asked to subpoena Mr. Potter, I believe his name.
Porter, yes.
Porter. And are they also contending that they would have had the ability to be present to question this individual at that investigative stage?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly my understanding, that they wanted to have full-scale discovery available to them during the investigatory stage, not just simply ask the commission to subpoena a particular witness.
Okay.
And that's exactly part of what the problem is. The investigations and the commission actions involve 3 stages: the investigations, the conciliation stage, and the complaint adjudication stage. There are different personnel that are involved in all three. All three perform a different functions. The respondents claim that they are entitled to subpoenas at the investigation stage is wrong as a matter of law, and to begin with, it makes no sense. In virtually any kind of enforcement matter, the subjects of an investigation do not have subpoena rights prior to the invocation of formal proceedings, such as a grand jury. And there is no reason why the legislature would have provided that right in the context of a civil rights investigation. Second, there is no reason why in the context of a civil rights investigation and nowhere else would the legislature choose to subject third parties to potentially intimidating and abusive subpoenas from private parties. In fact, the opposite is true. For example, Section 4412.08 mandates that civil rights acts should be interpreted liberally to further the goals of fighting discrimination, not to frustrate them. Third, as a textual matter, the to the same extent language that respondents rely upon so heavily does not address the timing or the when stage of the proceedings. It only addresses the mechanical process requirements applicable to the issuance of subpoenas, such as duties to respond, sanctions, et cetera.
Counsel, explain to us why the fact that they asked that this individual be subpoenaed, and then thereafter the commission subpoenaed that person on its own behalf, obtained information, and wouldn't disclose it, refused their request. You're here arguing, well, this just talks about the mechanics, that we both get the same shot out of the chute, but you didn't.
But if it went to the complaint stage, Your Honor, it would be, and there was actually an adversarial proceeding going on, then both sides could subpoena the particular witness. This is the investigation stage. And during an investigation stage—
Wait, where is the statute limited in the fashion that you say?
Well, the statute says to the same extent and with the same limitation. That language is exactly parallel to B3A, the immediately preceding provision, which says the commission shall have investigatory rights subject to the same extent and subject to the same limitations as the Court of Common Pleas. Now, the Court of Common Pleas only has very limited pre-formal complaint filing discovery. So if you took that language, to the same extent language, to mean to the stage of a proceeding, it would make no sense as applied to the commission because nobody disputes the fact that the commission has the subpoena power during the investigatory stage. So the language has to mean something else. And what it means is that when both sides are in an adversarial proceeding with each other, that is, during the adversarial stage of the proceeding, then both sides have the same access to discovery. But when the commission is acting as an investigative body, it acts unilaterally, necessarily so, otherwise it wouldn't be able to function. Investigations can't proceed if—
Isn't that a lot of words that you want us to read into the statute?
No, Your Honor. I think the way that the to the same extent and to the same language echoes and completely replicates the language in B3A makes it clear because the Court of Common Pleas does not have pre-investigatory discovery except in a very limited basis, that they are referring to something else.
And what would that be?
Rule 27 allows some depositions occasionally prior to the institution of a formal complaint. There's some interrogatory exceptions as well, but it's not the general discovery that is available during a civil proceeding. And to the extent, Your Honor, that there's any doubt, the agency here is entitled to deference. It has adopted a rule that sets forth exactly this point that the respondents are entitled to a subpoena, and they could have subpoenaed, in fact, did subpoena Porter when they got to the adjudicative stage. They don't need to be able to do that during the investigative stage, and to be able to do that would allow any respondent to manipulate the timing.
Let me back you up to your last. The agency is entitled to deference.
Yes. Yes.
And your citation to authority.
The cite to that is Weiss versus Public Utilities, 90 Ohio State, 3rd. And Chevron, also from the federal level, indicates that an agency charged with the enforcement of a statute is entitled to deference in its interpretation. And in this particular case, we argue that there's really no ambiguity at all, that to the same extent language can't possibly mean what respondents say it does because of the damage it would do to the ability of this investigative agency or any investigative agency to do its work. There is just no parallel in which a particular agency has got subpoena power during the investigatory stage. Think of the havoc that could create to the ability of this commission, the Civil Rights Commission, or any commission investigating anything to do its job if it basically deputizes the respondents to be able to do something similar. And in terms of parallel and equal footing, it should be noted that the charging party does not have any subpoena rights or cannot get the commission to subpoena anybody on its behalf during the investigatory stage.
But isn't your quarrel then with the General Assembly? I mean, the language is, upon a written application by a respondent, the commission shall issue a subpoena in its name to the same extent, subject to the same limitations as subpoenas issued by the commission.
Your Honor.
The language is explicit, is it not?
Your Honor, it does not explicitly apply to the stage of a proceeding. That language.
Where does it say it doesn't apply to the stage of the proceeding? That's what I'm looking for.
It doesn't say that it does, and it doesn't say that it doesn't. But if you take, I mean, the language is ambiguous on that particular point. But if you take a look at
I think it's missing on that point.
Your Honor, if you take a look at the preceding provision, B3A, it says again, to the same extent and subject to the same limitations as the Court of Common Pleas.
I heard your argument.
The Court of Common Pleas doesn't have formal complaint discovery. So to the extent what the legislature is obviously doing in this argument is not referring to the stage of a proceeding, it's referring to when both sides have the subpoena power. They are, when the respondents do have the subpoena power at the adversarial stage, they have it at the same terms and the same conditions as the commission. And to hold otherwise, there is no indication here why the legislature, why the General Assembly in this particular area, especially, would provide a unique, completely unprecedented power to a respondent. There's not an equality argument here. As I indicated a moment ago, the charging party doesn't have access to subpoenas. There is no reason why they would provide this kind of authority at this particular point.
Which is why I said you should go to the General Assembly with this argument.
Well, Your Honor, we think it's fairly enough. It's clear enough that because it explicitly doesn't apply to the investigatory stage, It doesn't explicitly not apply. It doesn't explicitly, but the presumption certainly should be that it would not apply to the investigatory stage
Mr. Marshall, I keep going back to 3A, and you keep looking at that last sentence, but the beginning of subsection A talks about the investigatory stage, and it says the commission shall have access to these records, to this discovery. The commission shall have the subpoena power and may issue the subpoenas. And then you get to C, or to B, rather, which gives, or C, that gives the witnesses the same extent. B does that. A and B are underneath 3, which talks about hearing, subpoena witnesses, compelling attendance, and so on. So, you know, I know what you're highlighting, the language that seems to be limiting and saying that it's only to the extent that the Common Pleas Court has subpoena powers, but you're forgetting the majority of that section.
Actually, Justice Lindley, if you read that section sentence by sentence, it's interesting. The first part talks about investigations and hearing. The second sentence talks only about investigations when it talks about the Fourth Amendment kicking in with respect to investigations. And then you get to the portion dealing with, this particular provision. At that point, it's not particularly clear what they're talking about. And again, the parallel language, I'm repeating my argument here, if you can bear with me, but the parallel language doesn't work with respect to the Court of Common Pleas because there is no parallel investigatory subpoena power during at the stage of the Court of Common Pleas. The most sensical way to read this is to read this to consistent with every single investigative body that's out there and not to allow a subpoena to kick in if that did at a particular stage at the behest of the respondent and not the charging party, the commission will lose control of its investigations. There are 5,000 of these that are investigated every year. Respondents would be allowed to manipulate the process, et cetera. There is no indication, particularly with respect to the civil rights laws, that the legislature intended anything of the sort.
Let's go back just to beat this horse one more time. To your argument about the common, wouldn't it be fair to assume the legislature was simply referring to the process, the powers that the Common Pleas Court has, and the enforcement of those powers when there's a refusal to comply, and all of those things, that general reference, wouldn't that be a more sensible reading? That's what they were talking about, is you can handle this power and enforce it the same way you
absolutely
can.
Absolutely, and that's the point. That's what it means in B3A.
But so you're turning that into a timing question rather than a process question.
No, Your Honor, respondents are turning that into a timing question because respondents are saying that language means that they have the power to do and issue subpoenas at the investigatory stage. That doesn't happen in the Court of Common Pleas. They're the ones who are turning it to timing. We're the ones who are suggesting this doesn't deal with timing at all. It deals exactly with the kind of factors that you're talking about.
Now, you talk about wrecking investigations. Help us understand how the ability of a target respondent to subpoena and interrogate under oath a witness undermines an investigation.
Sure, there are a number of reasons. First of all, the witness, a witness or a complainant may be much more reluctant to come forward when they are being subpoenaed by a responding party than by the commission itself, which is on a fact-finding mission, as opposed to the respondents, which are on an adversarial mission at that particular time. Second, just simply dealing with the weight and the burden of having to issue subpoenas at 5,000 investigations would subject the commission to an incredible workload. Third, there's no limitation on what kind of information a respondent would want. I mean, having a commission investigate that
might... If it's the same as the common pleas court, and this was not the victim that was subpoenaed or requested to be subpoenaed here, was it?
It wasn't in this particular case, but...
Now let's stop with that. If a subpoena comes for the victim, same process, somebody can apply for a protective order and...
Actually, I'm wrong, Your Honor. It seems to me that the victim was being sought a subpoena in this case, as I recall the record, not just Porter. You could have a protective order, but I'm not sure what the grounds of the protective order would be necessarily. What you would get is, you might get some limiting questions, but I see that my time is up, Your Honor.
Your time is up. Thank you. And for the appellees, Mr. James Kiger, and I see that you're splitting your time. Is that correct?
May it please the court. If Your Honors, please, we would like to divide our time into two arguments. We see two issues in this case. I'd like to make my comments to first issue, and Mrs. King, my associate, would like the privilege of arguing the second issue.
Hey, watch your time. You'll be responsible for dividing it.
Your Honors, I'm here today on behalf of the American Legion Post 25, the appellee in this case, asking this court to affirm the decision of the 12th Appellate District for the simple reason we believe they're right in that the court, and there are two basic issues before this court. Number one, the first issue being whether or not the Civil Rights Commission, the appellant, can abrogate the plain meaning of the statute by a rule or in-house regulation, I call it. The simply put here, the Legion asked the Civil Rights Commission pursuant to 41-1204B at the onset of the conciliatory stage. There are three stages as we view it in this type of proceeding. There's the investigatory stage, the conciliatory stage, and then the litigious stage, if I can be so crude and just say it like that. We got to the place where the conciliatory stage came up, and we were at a place to where we wanted to try to negotiate a settlement of this cause if we could. We're a little small Legion outpost down in farm country, and so we thought, well, if we can settle this, we can, but we've got to know what the strengths and weaknesses are of our case.
Well, there was some question about whether or not there was a parole restriction on the ability of the complainant to serve alcohol as a result.
Correct.
Of
and
a felony
lottery
case.
Tickets, excuse me, Your Honor. Okay. And lottery tickets.
And if I understand it, the purpose of your subpoena was to question under oath the parole officer as to the scope of that ability to conduct those activities.
Partially. We wanted to see the written parole requirements, basically. That's what we wanted to see, so that we would be better in a position to negotiate.
Was that a subpoena Dukas tecum?
Sir?
Was that a subpoena Dukas tecum?
I believe it had the effect of it. We said produce the records. And they were not produced. The Legion just said... the Civil Rights Commission said, we don't have to do that at this stage. And we said, well, wait a minute. How do you expect us to advise our client to settle this case if we don't know what we're doing And we just don't know the basis of accepting your offers or rejecting them.
Counsel, if we accept your argument, then do you maintain that at the beginning of an investigation, you have the right to subpoena a witness, a complaining witness?
Yes, under the statute.
So as soon as anybody, under your interpretation, as soon as anybody would complain about any violation of the discrimination laws, the object of the complaint, the company or the employer, could immediately subpoena that complaining witness and take their deposition?
No, not the witness, Your Honor. We never subpoenaed the witness. We
I know you didn't, but
right.
The principle of law you're seeking is equal subpoena powers, correct?
Well, I think we have a right to subpoena, but you carefully choose the time you do it.
But if we write law the way you want, any company who is then complained against can immediately subpoena that witness under your inversion.
I don't think immediately. I think we have to wait until you see what develops. But the code does not
Certainly before the conciliation stage and certainly before the investigative stage, you can subpoena them under your version.
Well, there's nothing written in the statute that puts a time limitation. And, Your Honor, I always thought under Ohio law that we look at the plain language of the statute and we apply the plain language of the statute to determine the legislative intent, and the legislature intended to give the, let's say, the party that's being charged a little bit of due process at that stage. If you look at the overall spectrum of the code in reference to this section, it's the only one instance in which the party who's being charged or had the finger pointed at give them a little bit of due process. And really, if you look at it from a practical standpoint is many of these cases are settled in the conciliatory phase. But, you know, I don't like to go into a conciliatory phase of it with a stacked deck. I want to know what I've got, what the other side's got, so we can sit down and intelligently talk about it and say, okay, let's get this worked out. That's what this section of the code
is
really for.
Counsel, say you didn't execute the subpoena and you go into the conciliatory stage, and obviously the critical information you needed was whether there was a written preclusion from this woman working in a liquor establishment and selling lottery tickets. So the commission is finished with its investigation. You enter the conciliatory stage. You're sitting at the table and you say, what did the written verification from the parole officer say? Or, you know, what was a probation document from the court? I need to see that. Are you saying that at that point you would have been denied that information?
Well, had they denied issuing the subpoena, yes, because this information at the parole officer's hands came from an interstate compact, and we couldn't get it any other way. It came from Arizona. She had been convicted of a felon in Arizona, and she and her probationary package out there had been transferred to Ohio, and it was privileged, and we couldn't get it. And so we said, okay, look, you people get it. And they said, for us, no. But the very next day when we got turned down, they went and got it.
They went and got it,
yeah.
And they had the information.
Yes.
And did they refuse to share that information with you at the conciliatory process?
Yes.
Okay.
We don't know to this day what's in that package.
Was there some point at which you understood the commission would reveal that information to you?
Well, it's never been made plain to me when it would be revealed, but I suppose after a formal complaint had been filed, I could subpoena it.
If, in fact, the commission had concluded its investigation and the result was adverse to you, would you not have an adequate remedy by way of appeal?
Yes.
And assert on an appeal these claims?
Yes, we would. That's true. There is a final appellate process. But, Your Honor, in this case, when they refused to make it available, we said, okay, mandamus to the Common Pleas Court. We're entitled to that if you apply the statute, and so Common Pleas judge, issue a writ of mandamus to them. Judge says, because you can wait until you're sued, if I can be so crude to say that, and wait till the outcome of that decision, and then you can appeal.
So the mandamus action was denied because the trial court determined there would be an adequate remedy at law by way of appeal if the decision of the commission was adverse to your interest.
Well, that, and he said it wasn't a final order, and the Court of Appeals said we respectfully disagree. Your Honor, my 7 minutes is up. I certainly appreciate the privilege. And now Mrs. King will address another important issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kiger. Mary King.
May it please the court. On that issue, if I may, as far as it being an adequate remedy at law, if there was one, we don't feel that there was, along with the Court of Appeals obviously felt that way, because we felt that this divested them of jurisdiction. The whole crux of the argument comes down to the conciliatory process, like your questions prior to this were whether we would receive the information during that process. We were absolutely told no. The only time would be after the complaint was issued. And as far as whether the information whether subpoenas could be sought at the onset of the investigation, it would only be after a charge is filed, not a complaint. There's two different things in the process. First, the complainant files a charge. Then after that formal charge is filed, then a formal complaint is filed. So only after that charge is filed, then could the respondent request a subpoena.
Charge comes right after the complainant. They can file the charge right after the complainant makes their initial complaint.
Yes, exactly. It's one and the same.
That's before they even do the investigation.
Yes, but it's not someone saying, well, I feel that I was discriminated. They've actually gone the step of notifying the commission, putting it on paper, and it's somewhat of a formal step that they have to take at that point. And at that point, they've also made the decision whether they're going through the Court of Common Pleas or whether they're going to use the commission.
So you would maintain that the once the charge is filed, that your right to a subpoena, you have the right to make it an adversary position from the get-go of the charge, not from the formal complaint?
Not per se an adversarial position.
You've got to accept the fact that if we rule in your favor, many, many attorneys will make it into an adversary position because they'll have investigative and subpoena rights.
I don't know that my opinion is that itself will not make it an adversarial time. In fact, I think that it already is. As soon as the commission contacts a respondent stating that they possibly have, that there's a claim of discrimination, at that point, they're told immediately to start providing information. You have to get these documents out. You have to get everything that we need to us by this date and time, which we did. We filed everything, went through all the hoops that you have to go through with that, and tried to aid the commission in that. So at that point, I think both sides are already in an adversarial position. The only difference here is with the subpoena itself, they are given the right to subpoena specifically at the investigatory phase, which we feel that the General Assembly is just giving us the exact same thing. So that way, this mandated part of conciliation, which it seems that it's a timing problem. Why would conciliation come before, you know, the parties have enough information to decide whether they can advise their clients to come to a settlement or not? But since conciliation is at that point, that's why the General Assembly gave the subpoena power. And that's why we feel that it's imperative. And in this case, it's also different because the parole officer, as Mr. Kiger stated, was under the interstate compact. Had this been a normal parolee, we could have gotten the information, just walked up and talked to him, but we couldn't because he was under
a duty. So, counsel, basically the flaw or the fly in the ointment here is at the conciliatory stage, everybody's cards are not on the table as you would have, say, in a pretrial or a court-mediated, ordered mediation session, something to that effect, that there is an unknown and there's no obligation, there's no way you can force the commission to disclose at that point, even though you're supposed to be there for a statutorily mandated session to settle the case?
Exactly, Your Honor, and that's where we felt that we were ethically bound not to, or to advise our clients not to settle, because we felt that without that information, it was unethical to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. King. Mr. Marshall, you've consumed all your time, but we'll allow you 1 minute of rebuttal if you choose to take it. You're not required to.
Mr. Marshall, before you begin, is that standard operating procedure that the cards are kept close to the vest during a conciliatory proceeding?
The commission can share some information during that proceeding if it chooses.
Why would it not share all the information in the effort to have a resolution to the problem before you have to take the next step, which is much more onerous, burdensome, and time-consuming?
There may be confidentiality requirements. Again, one of the requirements during the process is that the information collected by the commission stay confidential during the investigative process, which, by the way, is yet another problem with allowing the subpoena power to go to the respondents at an early stage. There may be some confidentiality requirements, but the commission, I would point out that this really isn't a settlement in the traditional notion of the word settlement. It's a conciliation, it's an attempt to get a respondent to begin to comply with the law. That's what the statute's all about. It is not what you might consider a settlement. And in that respect,
in a conciliation session, who has the ability to accept? I'm presuming that the commission lays out what they'd like to see happen. The employer would respond in what they're willing to do, if anything. And then is it solely up to the commission, or do you consult with the employee at that point? Is the employee interjected in any way in that
process? The employee can be involved, but it's the commission's choice. The commission is the one that brings compliance. An employee may be satisfied with that or not. And it may be that the commission chooses not to go ahead at all and not even proceed to the investigative stage. The employee at that particular time period in the investigative stage is not a formal party to the proceeding. It's just the commission, which is why it's incorrect to call this really adversarial in the traditional sense, because it's not a complainant versus a respondent. It is the commission doing an investigation, deciding whether or not to go forward, seeing that there may be a chance for conciliation, and if there is a chance for conciliation, we'll proceed on that basis. But there is no due process right for a respondent to be fully prepared as they might like during that conciliation stage. Rather, it is within the commission's discretion as to how they want to proceed on that. And then if for one reason or another, the parties don't come to a meeting, then there's a formal complaint proceeding. And at that point, the respondents have every single power available to them, subpoena power available that the commission does.
If
there really
the commission,
isn't any harm.
If the commission were trying to reach a conciliation, why would it not share the results of the information that the commission obtained with the respondent?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I imagine that most times that they would. They would try to share whatever information they could.
We have one here where it didn't.
Your Honor, I'm not the reason as to why and what goes on in a particular conciliation meeting is confidential. So what happened here is not on the record.
Okay.
I do understand that there are some factual discrepancies from what I am told occurred and what the respondents say it's occurred, but that's not on the record. Because conciliations are not on the record, but there may be some, in certain circumstances, some confidentiality limitations at that stage which prevent the commission from going forward.
When would the respondent in this situation be able to avail itself of the statutory provision, in your view?
After the complaint was filed. After the complaint was filed, they could subpoena and they could get the information. That they could get the information that way.
But not after the charge is filed, after the complaint.
But the charge, there are 5,000 of these. And it really, I can't emphasize enough what this would do to the commission. They would be spending all of their time adjudicating discovery requests of one kind or another.
Thank you.
Your time is go ahead.
I was going to say, but Mr. Marshall, what we have to decide is whether this regulation unreasonably conflicts with the statutory language. That's the real crux of this case.
That's correct, Your Honor, and for the reasons we presented earlier, we don't believe it does. That statutory language doesn't directly state that they're entitled to this during the investigatory stage.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. I neglected to tell the lawyers that Chief Justice is obviously not here this morning. He has read the briefs and will be able to watch your arguments and will be fully participating in the deliberations.